SQL Down Under is a podcast for professionals working in the SQL Server community. SQL Server is a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions expressed during the podcast are individual opinions and may not reflect the opinions of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation.
Introducing Show 87 with guest Ronan Arely. Guest today is Ronan Arely. Ronan is a senior consultant and an applications and data architect with more than 20 years of experience in a variety of programming languages and technologies. He was awarded as a Microsoft MVP 7 times and is active in communities mostly related to Microsoft Azure, data platforms, and .NET programming. Ronan's a moderator in the Microsoft forums, a member of the board at Microsoft Learn Community, and administers several large data platform groups on social media. A prolific writer of technical blogs, tutorials, and articles, he leads the Data Global Hebrew User Group and the Cloud Data Driven User Group in New Jersey. Ronan's also a co-administrator of the Data Driven Community and the principal organizer of the Future Data Driven Summit, which is where I've mostly come across him. So welcome, Ronan.
Thanks a lot. Hello, Greg, again. And hello, everyone. It's lovely to be here today.
So what I get everyone to do, Ronan, so tell people about who you are and how you came to be involved with SQL Server at all.
Oh, this is actually an interesting story, and it's related to the topic that we plan to talk today. Let me take you back to 1985. I came to the world of computers in the early 80s. In 1985, I developed my first computer game. Mm-hmm. I was 14 years old. At that time, for me, databases were just a tool. And to tell the truth, I quite underestimated the DBAs. It was for me, like working with databases, like working with Office, you know, click, and quiet. Because I saw only the side of the queries, and I did not understand what was beyond. Mm-hmm. In 2000, I worked at Tel Aviv University. As part of my work, I managed several servers, Unix server, Windows server, including the web server, which has SQL Server 2000. So you could say that SQL Server 2000 was my entry into the world of SQL Server. Mm-hmm. But practically, there was one specific point in time which I can point to that led me from programming as a major occupation to the world of database. There was one specific time, it's exactly like point in time that you can point why I moved from developing mm-hmm. as major occupation to working with databases. You can definitely blame Paul Randall for this. Mm-hmm. It happened around 2006 or 2007 when I came across an article of Paul Randall about the internals of SQL Server storage using the undocumented tools, DBCC page, mm-hmm. DBCC, and this, it got me.
Sort of interesting. I think the first time that people look at DBCC page, there's just a look on their face that people get when they first look at that. It's one of the things I often do in indexing classes, for example, is even just start with a heap and then you show people what the page looks like and then they just look and go, oh yeah, you know, it's cool.
Yeah, but for me it was more like I didn't consider a DBA work like something that it's professional. It was for me Okay, any child can learn SQL language. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was to work as a teacher, and I taught the SQL as part of the computer science in high school. I'm telling you, SQL is something that in 1 week you can learn it from start to end.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how I treat the work of DBA. And once you can go inside the internals, you understand, no, there is a lot more of it. You can actually dive to interesting, to performance, to what you can get in order to get the power of the data.
Listen, I completely agree with you on the fact that a good knowledge of the internals is critical to getting the right outcomes. But I know one time when I was talking to one of the product group members, he said to me that every time that I think that, he thinks that's something lacking in the product, in that if I had to know that, then that's a pity. You know, I mean, I still do have to know that. But the question is, do you think the system should be, I mean, it is very forgiving, but do you think it needs to be even more so?
I think that without going inside the internals, it's like driving a car mm-hmm. without knowing what in the under the skin, the engine
yep.
itself. Most people can do it. Most people do not mm-hmm. care about the engine. But then you do not really use the power of the car. Think about the journey that we are doing of learning. It's often tempting only to focus on how to use a tool. But after all, at first glance, it's good. But when you want to dive and to understand and to use it, you need to go to the internals. Any driver, any professional driver, learn about the engine. In fact, he can take place of any motor car shop that fixes cars. He don't do it on a daily walk, but the knowledge helps him to drive the car. This is the same with SQL Server.
Hmm.
I will show you some example in this short meeting. Not so, but I will present and speak about several examples that you can actually see that understanding the internals, it's not only for saying, oh, I know exactly what we have, I learned the deep dive into the internals. No, this is for daily work.
Yeah.
This is in order to improve your performance, improve your work. So we can go through a few example.
That'd be great. Yeah. So, like, what's the number one thing that you wish people knew about how the engine works?
This is a good question. Yeah, it wasn't the first one. Because really, it's like everything. If you need to select one thing, I would say that the most important is to understand how the value itself is stored in the disk.
Mm-hmm.
The zero. One. In fact, if you know this information, then you can understand a lot of the mistakes in forums mm-hmm. and questions. Think about, for example, people that speak about the format of a date.
Yes.
They think about the type of the client. SQL Server does not have a format of date. Mm. If you learn the internal, you know that date is simply integer behind
yep.
the skin. There is no difference between this. It's stored like an integer if I'm talking about the date.
Yeah.
We have a more complex daytime types, like daytime 2, which is mm-hmm. Probably the most interesting. But it's all important to understand. If you understand it, so when someone tells you, oh, I'm selecting the data from my SQL server, and the data comes in the wrong format, so what do I need to change in the server? And the answer is nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
Another issue. It's a client issue. You need to change your query. You need to change the client application that you use, maybe the connection string, and et cetera. So this is the one thing that is the most important.
At least SQL Server has some richness in data types. I have a friend always used to joke that in Excel that everything is a number or a string, and anything else is just an illusion.
It's not correct, and behind the scene, it's also not correct, but we are not speaking about Excel today.
Yeah.
Excel has data types. You need to select the right data type, and the way it presents the data is dependent on the data type itself. Yeah. If put it as a text, it will be different than put it as a number or a date, mm-hmm. and the calculation is different as well. So it's not a good example, but there are a lot of databases which don't have types.
Yeah.
Think about using JSON.
Mm-hmm.
You configure inside the JSON or in the XML, if you store an XML, you can't configure the type in the text itself.
Yeah.
But you don't have hard-coded type.
So yeah, actually, JSON's an interesting one because there was a lot of issue right up front when you mentioned dates and things, because part of the initial standards and all that, of course, there was not a standard format for the dates and things. And of course, the other one that's interesting is something that was null, of course, was just not there. But sometimes you want to know that the property is there, but it doesn't have a value if you're trying to derive a schema or something like that. Yeah.
This is important, but server implements JSON in a way that you can use null.
Yeah.
You can use the value for I don't want to call it a field because it's not a field, it's not a column, it's all one document. But you can configure the property and then use empty value.
Yeah.
But it's true that you can skip it because this is the standard of using JSON.
Hmm.
If you don't have the value, so the value is null, meaning there's no value. This is actually good.
Hmm.
It can make a document really shorter. And
yep.
Smaller data to store. So this is an advantage. And you can choose how to store the data. If you are using JSON, you can choose if using the empty value, which will be considered as a null. And again, I'm talking about empty value, not empty string.
Yep.
Obviously, JSON, if you want to use empty string, you will put a quotation without any value inside.
Yeah.
This is a value of empty string. But if you don't put any value, this is considered as a null.
Yeah, but it's interesting. In fact, I was reading a thing yesterday where somebody was having to deal with a database that, again, was one of the ones that had no distinction between, they didn't want any nullable things. And so they actually put a tab character in a string in every place where they meant it to be null. And you just went, whoa. Okay.
But,
yeah.
Not a standard. I prefer to follow standards usually. Even so, I'm not strict on this because... I prefer performance and actually working better over standard. But we need to follow the standard as much as we can. So tabs, it make it nice, but it simply use space in this case.
Yeah, no, that was always a thing back in SQL Server 6.5 and earlier, was that whole null handling thing was not very good. But I always get nervous about a magic value anytime you store something to mean something else. Because as soon as you do that, everything involved has to play the game, and invariably those values end up coming out of systems or getting displayed somewhere or something because something didn't play along, with the fact that that was a magic value.
That's a great topic for another show. Very knowledge, like huge topic, and there are multiple issues that come with using null in different way, in different standards. So, yeah, but I will say that if we are focusing on internals, this is less important in SQL Server, because again, we spoke about JSON, but JSON is not a type, as you mentioned.
Worth noting that we can mention the fact that there is a private preview that UC has blogged about, talking about the new JSON type. So that is coming.
Let's speak about the private preview, only what can be coming.
That's right,
that.
Only mentioning what was in his blog post. Yep.
I agree. It was actually a long time ago that it was published.
Mm-hmm.
Because they need people to join the private preview, so they published the...
That's right. Yeah. Can't tell you about it, but I can tell you what was in the blog post.
And personally, I can say that before 2016, I worked with a private preview, and this was one of my recommendations. I asked JSON to be a type, not to be a using a string. I gave a lot of explanation why. And it wasn't the way Microsoft decided to go.
Yep.
I'm really happy that it will be changed, because it gives us a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually related to the internals, because as I said, today it's not related because we are using simple text. So it's like storing en varchar. But once it's type, like XML, then the storage as well, probably, because we cannot speak about the private preview.
Yep.
But it's simply a suggestion, a guess that the internal will be differently.
Hmm. It's one of the things that's interesting, though, when they come out with code that provides something and we don't yet have the type. Like, so people probably don't remember, but in SQL Server 2000, we got the SQL XML things added onto that in about 2003. And so you could have four XML and things like that as part of the query. But the funky thing with that is that if I ran a query and I had a subquery that said four XML, the problem is, what data type is that subquery, right? And so it was only a string because we didn't have an XML data type. And so in 2005, when we got an XML data type, then they had to add the type directive to say, oh, I really meant XML, you know? And so that's a funky thing. And so again, we're going to have the same sort of thing if we end up with a JSON type, if that ends up in the product, because again, we've got subqueries and things at the moment that do for JSON that return strings, and they're not going to change that. So we're going to have some way to turn that into JSON if there is an actual type. And so, yeah, it gets confusing when things come out at different points in time.
Yes, this might make some of the application not backward compatibility, because they will want to use the type and not simple text.
Yeah, I suspect they'll probably do something not the same as what they did with XML, but I because again, there are standards for how other languages have done this, but it is a challenge where you have a subquery that returns a type, yet the type doesn't exist, you know, so, and then you later add the type. I mean, because they can't afford to break everything that's already there.
But all backward compatibility, most of the backward compatibility, what you can do is just continue with what you have and add for the new.
So it
can be a parameter, for example. You add the parameter and then it will return as a type.
A different thing. Yeah. And so, look, it's one of the things I've always loved with the SQL Server side of things, is that I recently had to do some work on some SQL Server 2000 code, and it is beautiful that, you know, I can pretty much take it as it is And it works, you know, basically. I mean, a couple of minor things here or there, but I mean, it's really, really minor. Whereas if I take a Visual Studio C-sharp project that I worked on 3 months ago, sometimes it takes me, when I open it, like an hour to get it back to where it was. And that was only 3 months ago.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure about 3 months, but there are moving between them, it's
I had one recently where I opened it up and it had a handful of dependencies, and the dependencies, the libraries, had dependencies. And then the upgraded ones were incompatible with each other, you know, and then you just go, oh, my goodness.
That had this issue. I have an extension for SSMS, which I developed a long time ago, and I updated it for each version. Yep. So for Visual Studio 2022, I did not update it. Mm-hmm. I decided that I will update it to work with SSMS 2022, but the code itself, I will continue to use the Visual Studio 2019. Because the differences are too complex to convert it.
It is hard. Yeah, it's if I could wave a magic wand with the Management Studio team, two things I would love to see. One is a proper extensibility model. That would be high on my list. And the other one is I want it to remember passwords again. Prior to version 17, it used to reliably remember passwords. Now it doesn't. And for the life of me, I can't seem to work out what it is that what's broken, but something broke. And so...
Don't care because I have an external application for password.
Yep.
I don't care about such, but I totally agree regarding Visual Studio and moving from version to version. Very complicated. Part of this, or mainly because the .NET version as well was totally changed.
Yeah.
So when Visual Studio take you to the new version, they also, without telling you, take you to the new version of Visual of .NET. So you get a different framework. Now, if you are taking .NET 2 and 3, it's the same. It's only addition. Yep. But 4 was totally different.
Well, 2 and 3, so, 3... For those that aren't into .NET, I mean, 3 was really 2 with extra bits.
With the step, there was update and update. And one thing that Microsoft said, oh, this is version 3.
Yeah.
I didn't even feel it.
Didn't feel like version 3, no.
No one should use it. I don't know who. all the members here remember .NET 1 was awful, full of bugs. It was nothing that someone should use. And then there was that change to .NET 2, which is great. Really great. In 3, there was a 3. There isn't 3. 2. But 4, again.
Yeah.
So this was to bring you this problematic into the client side, because it does not even tell you that, oh, you update Visual Studio, behind the screen now, by default, you will use the new .NET framework.
Yeah, indeed.
This is part of the why your work and all the project do not fit the new Visual Studio. More than they remove some of the built-in project.
Yeah.
For example, you mentioned the SSMS extension. There used to be in Visual Studio a special extension, a special project for extension for Visual Studio.
For Visual Studio, yes.
VX, I don't remember exactly the name.
Yeah, there was a VSIX project template extension, yeah.
This template that I used for my extension. And it's not coming anymore with the new Visual Studio. So it's a problem. It's a totally different template. You cannot use it without starting the project from scratch.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that the extensions for SSMS, they've never really officially like supported any of them, but I'm hoping that in the future that might change. But see, even with, I think the next version of SSMS, if people haven't used 20 yet, then probably need to have a look at 20, but mostly that's connection dialogues and encryption and things like that. The next one after that will no doubt be the one that goes to the Visual Studio 64-bit shell, you know, and stuff. And that's a substantial change, you know, when that happens. And so I've got a Management Studio Tips and Tricks book that lots and lots of people get every week, but I've been starting to revamp that, but I'm starting to think I might wait until the next version with the next shell to really get serious about it, because I have a feeling that will change so many things.
Hi, this is Greg. Just wanted to thank you for listening to this show and let you know that if you'd like to let me teach you more about SQL Server, we now have both free courses and low-cost courses available online and on demand. The courses include detailed hands-on lab work for you to complete to reinforce your learning, and there are more courses coming in the next few months. You'll find details at training.sqldownunder.com.
Yeah, we have this promise from the SSMS team. They said the next version will be a huge difference, better performance. SSMS has a lot of problems with performance, so they promised that it will be changed. This is in public post.
Startup performance seems to have become a real issue. I'm trying to remember when that started too. It was about version 17 or 18, where it just got really, really slow starting up.
Yeah. Application itself.
But anyway, I'm sure that'll be top of their mind, because so many people will have told them that. So yeah.
I have seen a lot of improvement, but I'm talking about the live version. I'm not sure if it's improvement in the SSMS, or maybe because I started a new laptop and it's all clean.
Yeah.
I didn't see to put my finger on the exact reason, but I do feel better now. And again, I'm not
That's
talking
good.
About the network, I'm talking about the current version.
So apart from how data is stored, what's the next main thing you think really matters about the internals?
First, about the data store and understanding it, it's not just because I want to understand how the data itself stored, but it's also because I can use this information. I can tell you that I had several cases, don't try it at home, but I had several cases that people come to me and say, I have a corrupted database. What can I do? If you actually know the internals and how everything is stored behind the skin, you can go inside just to the binary data, the binary data, the 0 and 1, and find the data. You can take, for example, let's say that you have a specific place in the disk that was corrupted. And you lost only one value, one zero, you have a one instead of a zero. And you lost a value, SSMA, I'm trying to say SSMS because it's talking about SQA, but I meant to say SQL Server. SQL Server will mark the database as corrupted, and you will not be able to use this data. But if you understand how SQL Server store the data, and this specific column was part of an index, so you might take the data from there. You might actually find the data.
That's right, it may actually still be there,
You've done it, not a lot, but a few times. And you can just go and fix corrupted data. This is one case, there are a lot of cases that you can find the missing data in other places. Not in the column, not in the record of the row itself, but the data exists somewhere and you can use it. And if it doesn't exist, let's speak about database that you have a corruption, and you have backup. What you will do if the database is 100 terabytes, will you go and now restore all the database? Let's say not all the database. Usually we backup only files in the database, mm-hmm. or we have different backup. But again, you need to restore something that you don't need. If I need only one value, do you know that I can take it directly from the transaction log?
Yeah.
The transaction log has all the transaction that you are doing. So if you have the insert in the transaction log, you can take the value from there. There are three undocumented sort procedures that we can use in order to read the data directly from the backup of the transaction log or from the live transaction log. And there is a third one, which is a new, which we can use for both. So using this knowledge, you can actually do a lot. Speaking about transaction log, I had a very, very nice lecture at PAS Summit mm-hmm. 2 years ago about this. I spoke about how you can parse the transaction log file, the binary yep. file, how you can use it. For example, there are cases that you want to have not mirroring, but you want to have I forgot the word in this. You want to have to connect the database, and mm-hmm. one of them is enterprise, and one of them is standard.
Yeah.
You cannot do it if in the standard edition you used, for example, something that it's not supported in the enterprise,
mm-hmm.
Like creating index, like building index on the fly. This will not support. But when you will try to do the connection, it will not tell you what is the problem. It just tell you, oh, you cannot use it. If you can read the backup file, which you can use, the procedure that I mentioned, then you can go and find the exactly point in time that tell you, oh, this action, this specific action mm-hmm. is supported in standard edition. So all you need to do is to go and fix this specific action. And you have a lot of such cases that knowing the internals of the transaction log can help you in daily work. We spoke about the storage. We spoke about the transaction log. Think about a different case. Now, let me ask you a question. I asked this question, a few years ago, multiple people. If I create two tables, exactly mm-hmm. the same as in the structure, the only difference will be the order of rows. Can this impact performance, for example?
The order of the columns?
Yeah.
Possibly. Actually,
let's say one table, it's a create table, column one, int slash column two, int, and etc. Now I'm taking the exact same code, create table. I only change the order in the command of creating the table between column one and column two. Mm-hmm. That's all. This impact performance. It impacts queries because if you are a developer, so you will probably use a select star, which mm-hmm. it's a good idea, but a lot of people do it. I do it as well when I'm lazy.
Sure.
And this will impact the order of columns that you get from the query.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is different. I'm talking about the performance, for example. Can something like this impact performance? I will remind everyone, if you're not familiar with how SQL Server stores the data. So SQL Server basically stores the data in two groups. All the fixed length and
the variable length, yep.
In one place, mm-hmm. and all the variable data type are in a different place.
Hmm. Potentially with an overflow as well. Yes.
Yeah. So you can understand from this that the order that I will use in order to create the table will not necessarily will be related to the order that it is actually on the disk.
Not at all.
So again, is it important to the order of columns? If I ask this, and I asked this multiple people before I had my first session about this topic, I asked a lot of people, including MVPs and even Microsoft employees and experts in Stack Overflow. I asked people with people of the top contribution in Stack Overflow. And you can split the groups of the answer into two. Developer says immediately, yes, the order is important. And mm-hmm. we spoke about the select star. But this was not my question. I was focusing on performance and actually working with the data. So what will be your answer to people that ask you this question?
I could imagine scenarios where that would matter. But in the vast majority of cases, I would have said no.
So, as I said, I asked about 10 expert MVPs, data platform MVPs, and none of them gave the right answer because they all say about the same that you have said. It will not impact performance. Now, we don't have... I don't have the option to share my screen here, but I have... talks about it. What you will say if I will tell you that I have a script, it's a long script because it's doing a lot of action, and the only thing that I change is the order of two columns. At the beginning of the script, I create a table, and then I'm doing a lot of insert and the other action on the table. But the only thing that I will change is the order of two columns at the beginning. The result will be 10 times bigger table.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. As I said, I wouldn't rule it out, but I would have thought it'd be pretty much an edge case by the time you do that. Because I suppose the thing I look at is that it depends on a number of other things as well. So for example, it depends how I added that second column. So if I added the second column with a default nowadays, it won't even store the column now when I add it, and so on and so on. So, yeah.
I'm talking about the same suite. Mm-hmm. You add the same column, exactly the same column, the same type. Everything is the same. The only difference that I'm doing is split the order of the two first column. And
What you're thinking of, but I'd love to know.
Yeah, don't worry. I told you, no one gave the right answer, including all the MVPs that I asked, including the Microsoft employees that working with the SQL Server. In reality, I can show you it very simple. As I said, you can take that script from one of my posts and just run it. And the explanation is, if you understand what is happening behind the skin about tables, then you know that SQL Server has like a hidden physical table structure. Mm-hmm. What we have with the table structure, it's not what actually we have behind the skin.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about the situation, for example, that I remove a column from the table.
Yep.
SQL Server does not remove the column from the table.
No, it just takes it out of the metadata. Yeah.
Of the column, unless the column is at the last, it's the last column, then it removes. But if the column is not at the end, so SQL Server will not necessarily remove it. not even from all the old rows, which are already stored.
Well, it doesn't need to, right? I mean, as long as it takes it out of the column metadata.
It's a great way to work. But now think about a situation that you add column.
Yep.
When you add a column, SQL Server can use the old place for the new column, or it can edit after the last one.
Yep.
You understand the internals, so you can follow the different actions that you do. And there are actions that actually change the physical structure of the table. And there are actions that are not. So what I have done, I just run in that long script several queries that change the table structure, like remove a column, add index, remove index.
I do
the same on two tables, which the only difference is the order of the column.
Mm-hmm.
But in one table, the order of the column make it make the SQL Server be able to use the same space.
Yeah, so and it's either use the space or it's not. Yeah. And so, the same number of rows don't fit on the page. Yep.
Exactly. So at the end, you get two different tables. Mm. If you will check, you will run a query on the system database, system tables, and you will check what is the structure of the table. It will tell you it's the same table. It's the same structure. But there is undocumented store procedure that you can actually check what is the physical structure of the table. And then you will find it totally different. And then you will
understand the one table
10 gigabytes.
Yeah. It would be easy to do. Yeah. The one that had me fascinated with this is I came across the other day is, of course, back in 2012, we got the ability to add a column to a table without it being a whole of data operation. And that was a magnificent thing, because prior to that, if you added a column, it used to just go through and rewrite all the stuff. And so the column was there. But what I used to think is that if you added a column and it had a default value, that it would actually go and do a whole of data operation. But again, it is clever enough not to do that. And so if you say, add a column, you know, here's the default value, it just puts the column default details in the metadata, but it doesn't rewrite any of the rows. And so if you go to access a column and the column's not present in the row, it just goes, it's the default value, which is kind of cool. And then I thought, well, okay, so where do you wear the pain? And then I thought, well, if you then dropped the default, I thought, what would it do? Right? And so the question is, does it then go through and then write it at that point? Because then you think, well, if I move on new rows, but it doesn't, because it actually has a flag that says whether there's a default or not, but it also remembers the last default. And so even in that scenario, they don't need to store it. It's actually got cleverer and cleverer and cleverer. Yeah.
The metadata is so important. It's so clever, we can say, that it can use the metadata instead of storing data inside the table itself.
Yep.
We talk about binary, the binary value. Even in the binary value of the data, it does not store all the value. There is a very common mistake on forums. By the way, again, forums that are written by experts that speak about internals, a lot of them, I can say almost everyone, using a convert to binary of the value in order to show people what is the way that the value is stored on the disk. This is a huge mistake, because when you convert to binary, so you also add to the value some information that in the table does not exist. It's in the metadata.
Yep.
Take, for example, date time two. When you use Python 2, you don't need the lens.
The precision scale, any of those sorts of things don't need to be there. Yep.
In the metadata.
Yep, exactly.
When you convert the value into a binary, which most of the, I'm saying most, but I wrote a post several years ago about take time to internal. I didn't had any help. I didn't find any blog that helped me to know how it is stored behind the screen. I did a reverse engineer. You have it all in my post. Hmm. All the procedures, I explain how I did it step by step, the reverse engineer, how I found out. And the reason is that every blog that I tested and read spoke about using convert to binary, and then he said, here, this is how datum 2 is stored. And I said,
No.
The lens is not the same. You see that it's 2 bytes more, so it's not correct. And the
what confuses it a lot more now, of course, is that we pretty much always use at least row compression, if not page compression. And then, of course, the page format becomes a little more complicated, you know, to work out.
In those cases, and this is the reason that the most simple way to work with the internals, it's not actually to read it in Notepad++, which is what I'm doing in my when I speak about internals and present it in practical, but use DBCC page in order to read the binary data. This it bypass the issue of compress because it gives you the uncompressed.
But it also, most of the time, if you look at it directly, it gives you the sort of, you can see the dictionary, you can see, you know, all of those things there. I mean, they're all there, but that's good. And I think clustered column stores would be another one that would be a world of entertainment to, I haven't really spent much time staring at the pages for those. So, but I know roughly what would be in them, so yeah.
Very interesting. Knowing about this can help us to improve our compression tools, when to use column store and when to use...
Yes, knowing how they work. Hey, listen, so look, that's pretty much bringing us up to time, Ronan. Where will people see you coming up? We mentioned the future data-driven summit, so tell us about that. I know I've been involved with that for a couple of years and always enjoyed it, so...
Okay, so... As part of my community activities, one of the community that I lead, I co-admin together with Jen Joseph from Microsoft, and about 2 weeks ago, Anna Weekly joined us as well. It's the data-driven community. And the data-driven community has two branches of activity. We have a weekly user group meeting, and we have the conference. The early conference called Future Data Driven Summit, which is what you mentioned. This is a shared conference for multiple data platform communities. It's a big event. Last year, I checked, I used Google and Bing, and I tried to find a bigger event. There isn't. Last year, according my check, it was the biggest virtual. There is a physical event, like a past summit, but according to my check, it was the biggest virtual event in the world for data platform. So it is coming back, and the conference is on September 25, but the call for speaker is now. It's open, so... Please use Google.
Now's the time.
Give me on LinkedIn or Facebook. I will give you the link. I cannot give you it here because we don't have option to share screen. But
I'll put a link in the blog post for the show. Yeah,
so. Big way, because it's very important Search Future Data Driven Summit 2024. It's upcoming. The call for speakers is open. We also have a call for sponsors. If anyone familiar with a company that can help, it's always good.
Yep.
Because we like to buy swabs for you. Mm-hmm. Nothing goes for the team. All the organization is volunteer totally. But last year, we sent all the speakers a nice T-shirt, for example, and we had a lot of swags during the conference itself. If you're familiar with someone that can sponsor the event, everyone, you are welcome to point them to me. And if you want to speak, Future Data Driven Summit 2024, call for speaker is open. Join us.
Terrific. So listen, thank you so very much for your time today, Ronan.
Thank you for inviting me.
All good.